What I remember most about that night is not a scream or a sudden call over the radio, but the way the road looked when the patrol lights first cut across it, a stretch of Louisiana asphalt that had no business being part of a death scene, bordered by darkness and ordered by darkness and the quiet assumption that anyone left there would be seen in time, because that is what people believe about roads, that cars mean witnesses and movement and safety, even when the hour is late and the traffic is thin. And as I stood there, with the smell of damp earth and exhaust in the air, reviewing what we already knew and what we did not, it was clear that this was not a single event, but a sequence that had already unfolded long before the body was found, involving choices made elsewhere, people who crossed paths and then separated, and a young woman who did not arrive home after a night out, and whose final moments would be argued over in courtrooms and public forums long after the evidence was logged, because the name at the end of that chain was Madison Brooks. I first encountered Madison Brooks through records rather than photographs, which is how most cases begin for me, with enrollment confirmations, address histories, and the routine paperwork that establishes a person is real in administrative terms before you ever understand who they were to the people around them. She was a college student in Baton Rouge, attending Louisiana State University, living the kind of life that leaves a clear paper trail, but few warnings, classes attended, friends visited, weekends planned around social events rather than risk calculations. And when I reviewed her background, there was nothing in it that suggested she was moving towards something catastrophic, only that she was young, active, and integrated into the rhythms of campus life. The night that would later become the focus of national attention began, as many college nights do, with plans that were informal and subject to change, transportation arranged on the fly, and an assumption that familiar places were safe because they were familiar. Statements from friends and witnesses established that Madison went out with people she knew, that alcohol was involved, and that the locations visited were not remote or unusual for students in that area, which mattered later because it removed the idea that she had placed herself somewhere inherently dangerous through recklessness or isolation, an assumption that often appears when the facts are still incomplete. From the investigative side, the early hours are always about reconstruction rather than judgment. And as I worked through timelines compiled from phone data, bar receipts, and security footage, the picture that formed was not of a single bad decision, but of a series of transitions, one place to another, one group to a smaller group, each step narrowing the margin for intervention, without anyone present recognizing that narrowing in real time. This is common in cases involving social settings and alcohol, where no single moment appears decisive until it is viewed backward through the lens of outcome. What was known and later confirmed through multiple sources was that Madison left a bar with several men she had encountered that night, and that the group went to an apartment, a private space where public oversight ends and the evidentiary burden shifts almost entirely to testimony and forensic findings. When I reviewed the reports, I noted how quickly the environment changed from a public venue with cameras and staff to an interior location where accounts would later diverge, and where the consequences of what happened would not be immediately visible to anyone outside. The investigation into what occurred inside that apartment would become its own complex process, involving interviews, medical examinations, and legal determinations about consent and responsibility. But even at the outset, it was clear that something had gone wrong in a way that could not be explained by intoxication alone. The evidence collected would later support allegations of sexual assault, and those allegations would shape not only the criminal charges, but the public understanding of the case. Though at this stage, my focus was narrower, on establishing sequence and custody of actions rather than interpreting motive. After leaving the apartment, Madison did not go home, and this absence, noted first by friends and then by family, marked a point where concern shifted from routine to urgent. Missing person timelines are unforgiving, and every hour without contact adds weight to the possibility that something is seriously wrong. Yet in this case, the discovery came not through a search, but through a traffic incident reported by a passing driver, a collision that would pull the earlier events into sharp focus by forcing the question of how she came to be on that road in the first place. As I reviewed the initial call logs and emergency responses, it was evident that the responders treated the scene as they would any roadside fatality until the surrounding details emerged And that transition from accident to investigation is often where critical context can be lost if it is not preserved carefully. In this case, enough was preserved to allow the story to be reconstructed later, but the work was only beginning. The roadway where Madison Brooks was found was not designed for pedestrians, and that fact alone raised immediate questions when I arrived on scene, documentation, and later reviewed photographs and measurements, because people do not usually end up there by accident, especially at night, and especially without a vehicle stopped nearby. The driver who struck her contacted authorities, and the physical evidence was consistent with a collision rather than an intentional act, which narrowed one aspect of the case while widening another, focusing attention on how she came to be left there. Through interviews and digital evidence, it was established that Madison had been dropped off near the roadway by the men she had left the apartment with, a detail that shifted the investigation from a simple hit-and-run narrative to a broader examination of duty and decision-making. The vehicle involved in leaving her there was identified, and the accounts given by those inside it became central to the case, not only for what they said, but for what could be corroborated through location data and timestamps. The term "the tape" became shorthand during the investigation for the digital trail that followed Madison that night. Security cameras, phone pings, and other recordings that did not capture everything but captured enough to contradict certain claims. When I reviewed this material, I was struck by how partial visibility can still be decisive, showing movements without showing conversations, arrivals without departures, and how those fragments can be assembled into a timeline that holds up under scrutiny, even when the human narratives around them shift. Medical findings confirmed that Madison had been injured prior to being struck by the vehicle, which supported the theory that she was already in distress when she was left on the roadside. This was not speculative. It was based on documented injuries and expert interpretation, and it placed responsibility back on the moments immediately following her departure from the apartment. The decision to leave her there, rather than ensure she reached safety or seek assistance, became a focal point for both investigators and later prosecutors. As charges were considered, the case expanded into multiple legal pathways, including charges related to sexual assault and charges related to negligent homicide and failure to render aid. Each pathway required its own evidentiary standard, and part of my role was to ensure that the facts supporting each were clearly delineated, avoiding the common pitfall of allowing public outrage to blur legal distinctions. The public reaction was intense, fueled by the age of the victim, the circumstances of her death, and the perception that accountability might be unevenly applied. Throughout this phase, I was careful to document not only what was proven, but what was alleged, because the difference matters, especially in cases that draw national attention. Statements made early in the investigation were revisited as new information came to light, and some were revised or contradicted by evidence, which is not unusual, but underscores why early assumptions can be dangerous. The tape, in its various forms, served as a stabilizing reference point amid conflicting accounts. The driver who struck Madison was later arrested and charged, a development that closed one loop of the case while leaving others open. And even then, the legal process continued to unfold, with court dates, motions, and ongoing debate about responsibility. From an investigative standpoint, the moment had passed, but its implications were still being processed through the system. When a case like this moves beyond the initial investigation, what remains is not just evidence, but precedent. And I was aware as proceedings continued that the way this case was handled would be examined for years, not only by legal professionals, but by the public and by families who would see in it echoes of their own losses. The factual record became fixed over time through indictments, court rulings, and plea negotiations, and my role shifted from active investigation to documentation and review. Madison Brooks' death prompted conversations about campus safety, alcohol culture, and the obligations people have to one another in moments of vulnerability. But from my perspective, the enduring element was simpler and more exacting: a series of documented actions and omissions that led to a fatal outcome, each one supported by evidence rather than inference. The legal outcomes reflected that focus, separating what could be proven from what could be felt, a distinction that is often unsatisfying but necessary. In reviewing the final case files, I noted how the roadside where she was found became a symbol in public discourse, even though it was merely the last location in a chain of events that began hours earlier and miles away. This emphasis on location can obscure causality, and part of closing the case involved ensuring that the record accurately represented sequence rather than spectacle, so that responsibility was not misplaced or simplified beyond recognition. The investigative materials, once sealed and archived, tell a complete story in their own way, one that does not rely on narrative embellishment or emotional framing, but on dates, times, injuries, and decisions. It is not a story with a single villain or a single failure point, but one with multiple junctures where different choices could have altered the outcome, a reality that is uncomfortable but true and that does not diminish the loss at its center. What remains, ultimately, is the confirmation of what happened and the acknowledgement of its consequences, recorded in official findings and legal resolutions that will not change, regardless of public memory or media cycles. Madison Brooks is not a symbol in those records. She is a person whose life ended on a Louisiana roadway in 2023 after a sequence of events that were investigated, documented, and adjudicated. And that is where the story, in factual terms, ends.